At the end of the day, you can do all the due diligence you want on a company, but more to the point, if you get the sector right, the odds of you having success are greater. We're doing what everybody else should be doing, looking at earnings, looking at balance sheets, looking at, you know, what is management doing in achieving its goals and how are they doing that. These days, which is wonderful, there's great liquidity in these miners. When we started doing this in 2018, you know, the liquidity wasn't the same.
Introducing the Blockware Marketplace. Start mining Bitcoin today. This has the potential to transform the mining industry, as now anyone can buy a Bitcoin ASIC using on-chain or Lightning, see its historical and live hash rate before purchasing, and be earning Bitcoin mining rewards in minutes. This brings transparency and turnkey mining to a whole other level. Start mining Bitcoin today at marketplace.blockwaresolutions.com. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Blockware Intelligence Podcast. This week I have on Dan Weisskopf. Dan, welcome.
Hey Joe, this is going to be a lot of fun. Wouldn't you know, I'm getting spied on by Amazon here. You never know when they're going to come on.
I like it. Hilarious. Amazon's watching us. Yeah, this is great. Let's go ahead and dive right into it. I've never heard you on a podcast before, so I'm excited to hear, you know, what you have to say. Let's dive into your professional background. Like, how did you, you know, get into this space? And what did you do before
into, into this space, or my career journey, as they would say?
All of the above, yeah.
You know, listen, respectfully, I'm a little older than you. So I started it in 1987, a long, long time ago. And it's an interesting point in time for a whole host of reasons. One, it was right before the crash of 87. And the good thing about, you know, the crash was I didn't have any money. So I didn't have any money to lose, right, as they say. I worked in a family office. Thereafter, I ended up launching a hedge fund. And what I learned from those two experiences has helped me on a go-forward basis in a lot of ways. So at the family office, I had the opportunity to learn about venture capital. And we got really hands-on in the venture capital. And that, to your point, that kind of helps me out in what I do for Block, right? In the hedge fund, it helped me out today because, wait, I think it's really important as an investor to think both long and short. Nobody buys a stock or makes an investment thinking, well, I might lose money. They're always thinking they're going to make money. That's why they do it, right? And then when you have a hedge fund perspective or a short perspective, you generally put something on with a better perspective around risk. And I think that helps us out a lot in Block. I started really focusing in on ETFs around 2003. And that really makes me an early adopter. I tend to be an early adopter in everything that I do. Maybe it's my curious nature. But for ETFs, I came across it in a different perspective because in 1999, sorry, a long time ago, the rules changed for investors. And what changed was everybody's ability to get the same information at different points went away. Meaning, specifically, it used to be that, you know, if you did a lot of real due diligence, maybe you can get an edge with a wink, wink, nod, nod from the CFO, right? We called it back then insightful information. You know, things are good, wink, wink, right? None of that exists anymore. None of it exists. I remember I did my master's thesis, now we're going back even further, on pawn shops, which I'm kind of proud of, which, interesting enough, took me around Texas a lot, and I'll come to that in a minute. I sat down with a CFO back then, and I was looking for that wink, wink, nod, nod, and he said to me, Dan, no more, no more. I'm not going to jail for you or for anybody for that matter. And it was a miraculous change in the marketplace on a lot of levels. And it brought me into the ETF market because, listen, at the end of the day, you can do all the due diligence you want on a company. But more to the point, if you get the sector right, the odds of you having success are greater, right? So no surprise, that means that we're also very invested in thematics, which again, has to do with Block. And where I'm going on all this, in 2018, I joined a firm, Tidal Financial Group. It was Toroso at the time, but now it's called Tidal Financial Group. And we launch ETFs. We trade ETFs for issuers. It's about $6, $7 billion firm. Block is part of it. My focus is Block, just to be really clear. Listen, the blockchain space is plenty big, plenty robust, lots to change on a constant basis. And I'm taking all that I learned from 1987 and drilling deep into meeting with management teams to assess the risk and assess the opportunity for the Block investors. I'm looking at the world from a venture capital's perspective, right? I think it's so incredibly important when you're looking at all the change that's ahead as a result of the blockchain. And, when it comes to ETFs and what I've learned from ETFs, we're very creative in that regard. And some of the things that we can do using an ETF really makes a difference. So long-winded answer to your great question. I hope it's helpful. I think everybody's journey is different, but it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's an awesome background. Obviously great to see you in this industry now. So I know you are a co-portfolio manager of the Block ETF. Can you maybe explain to the audience, like, what is the ETF and maybe like, what is your strategy and like, what assets do you like? What opportunities do you like within that ETF?
Sure. Well, I mean, the core mandate is about transformational change that's going to occur from data sharing. I mean, that's the name of the ETF, of course. And as a result, what does that mean? It means we're not necessarily going to be one for one correlated with the price action of Bitcoin. If you like Bitcoin, great. Listen, I'm a fan too. You're probably as good or better off just buying Bitcoin directly, right? And putting it in your wallet and hoping it goes up in the future. What we bring to the table is much different, right? We do trade with a lot of correlation with the price action, but we're investing in the equities, right? So we're investing in the miners, and I know you're very familiar with the miners. And had some great meetings with miners. Right now, we're about 23% weighted to the miners, right? And, the interesting part about the miners for me is it brings back all my experience, right? How do you look at a balance sheet? Capital raising? What is the business model? I mean, the miners, if you look at them today, there's like a multitude of different models, right, on how they... Asset light, which is maybe not so asset light because you got to buy the equipment. It's less heavy. Maybe that should be like the statement around it. Which one of them HODL? Which one are developing, data centers or hosters? It's really kind of fascinating if you look at it, right? So I have a lot of fun visiting some of the sites and talking to some of the managements. And, it takes some time to really learn how to ask questions of managements, right? And so I've enjoyed that role that I have. So that's around 23% right now. Then beyond that, we get exposure to the price action of Bitcoin through direct ownership, meaning, we call it direct, but let me be very explicit, MicroStrategy, no surprise. It's our second largest holding today. It used to be our largest holding. That is, in a lot of ways, I don't think Michael Saylor would disagree with me on this, effectively like an ETF, right? You know, that's why people own it, right? And that company has a very interesting cap structure, which has helped him out in both raising money and maintaining control. So again, that goes back to my earlier days on how to approach things. And then we also own ETF spot Bitcoin funds through Canada. So that's about 10%. So that's where we get, you know, our greatest correlation in our portfolio to the price action of Bitcoin. But then we also have, you know, transactional as a category, which is right now in the high 20s, the Coinbases of the world, right? Square, PayPal. And then we also have applications as a category. And venture capital. Venture capital tends to be on the smaller side because, well, there are a few companies that are public that offer that type of exposure. Galaxy Digital is one that we include in that category. Overstock, surprising enough, is also one that we include in that category. So there are about seven different categories. Some people call them verticals, I call them categories, basically one and the same. And that's how we stay consistent with our mandate. I hope that makes sense. Feel free to drill deeper into it. And by the way, I'll also say one other thing. What is fun, a little more pressure for us, but it's also good for people to appreciate. We're fully transparent. Every day we list out our holdings. The ticker is BLOK, if anybody cares out there.
Yeah. No, I thought that was an awesome overview of what you guys are doing. You made an interesting point about the public miners, how they really all do have like very unique business models. Like none of them are necessarily the same, and you have different strategies within each one, and it makes sense like to have, you know, a portfolio of different ones as they're all, you know, trying to go at it a different way. So it's very interesting. I did have a question, like, how often do you guys like reallocate the portfolio or trade? You know, you said MicroStrategy, I think at one point was like your top holding, and then now it's maybe number two. Like, how often do you guys switch it up?
We don't rebalance as in the way a lot of folks think about ETFs. It's not a quarterly process. We meet every Thursday, the team that's focusing on block, but we also meet on Mondays as well, the whole investment committee at the firm. And that's about 15 people. And we cover the holdings, any problems, et cetera. So we make changes pursuant to our process and when things change. So we're a diversified fund, right? So we have certain limitations. If a position goes above, we'll say like 6%, we'll probably trim. Right. As an example, we'll put on a position at a 50 basis point or 100 basis point level. And it becomes a core position as we get more comfortable. Right. So a 3% weighting is ideal because at that point it can have a real impact. And listen, we're doing what everybody else should be doing, looking at earnings, looking at balance sheets, looking at, you know, what is management doing in achieving its goals and how are they doing that, right? So it's standard protocol in terms of how you manage a portfolio in my world. Now, part of what you're probably wondering about is how do we manage risk in a category that is, well, I don't know how to say it any different, highly volatile, crazy volatile. Lately, not so volatile, but it's erratic, in terms of looking at things, from a risk profile. And a lot of that is really a function of the industry being so new, right? Let's be honest about that. And we can cover that later, right? It's all up to you. I'll pause because I've thrown a lot at you and yeah, don't want to get too far ahead.
No, that's good. We can definitely dive into that in a sec. Before we get into that, I wanted to ask a quick question about high-level thoughts on this. The BlackRock ETF that was like now delayed. Like, what do you think about a spot Bitcoin ETF? Is it ever going to happen? Do you have any high level thoughts on BlackRock? However you want to take it.
Yeah. Okay. So I would say if they're successful, I'm pretty confident there'll be buyers, right, for the ETF. There's a lot of conversations that if they do launch it, well, will it be $1 billion fund or a $5 billion fund almost instantaneously? So I think if it does happen, it'll be a hugely positive event, right? Now, the question then becomes, what happens to GBTC, right? And does that convert before or after? And what happens with that spread, right? It's a tough one, right? It's a chicken and egg in certain respects, right? So will people sell GBTC because it's at a discount and they just want to get the pure play of the ETF? Or will they hold it and just wait for the discount to narrow? I don't know that anybody really knows. Because people also, I think, falsely make the presumption that if GBTC is allowed to convert, that it happens instantaneously, right? There's going to be a process behind that. And that there lies, I think, part of the reason perhaps why the big guys are playing now in the context of trying to launch an ETF, right? There must have been some catalyst that they saw to pull the trigger. And I think it's, I think there's a lot of conversations around the higher probability of GBTC converting these days. And that's led to, you know, the big guys playing in the idea of launching a Bitcoin ETF. And listen, I'm hopeful. I think it would be great. And particularly great because if you think about it, if I had BlackRock watching over my money, that might be a great thing, right? And making sure it's secure from a custodial standpoint. And I don't have to worry if I'm an institution around the mark, right? I give Michael Saylor a great deal of credit for what he did. Not a lot of CEOs would survive that decision of what he did or need to make that decision for why he did what he did. And I think it was very courageous. Having said all that, my last comment about BlackRock, particularly, is, you know, a lot of people own Bitcoin for its underlying decentralized value, right? So there's going to be some pushback. The institutions might like it, but the underlying ethos might be very, very skeptical with perhaps some good reason.
Yeah, definitely. Let's dive into Saylor a little bit. Like, I know when he had initially announced, like, he was going to, you know, go deep into Bitcoin, I guess back in 2020, I remember reading, like, the press release that came out. It was like, this random company, MicroStrategy, is all of a sudden buying a lot of Bitcoin. And we were like, what is going on? This is awesome. And then people thought that, you know, a ton of other S&P 500 companies would follow in his footsteps. And then nobody really did. Yeah. Do you think that, like, that's going to eventually happen? Or do you think, are you not surprised that it took, you know, that we are where we are today with, like, no one really following him to the same degree?
Well, very few companies could afford to do it right now, right? You know, it's a guaranteed mark against your earnings, you know, at some point. That's the way that's the way the FASB rule is. Now, that's going to change, which is going to be, I think, another step forward, right, for institutions and public companies to look at things differently. It's funny because my perspective of MicroStrategy is different than yours, because I remember when it was just .com, right? So I go back a little bit farther than you. And we bought really early. We watched the process, right? The whole idea of doing the Dutch auction, was important. He telegraphed what he was going to do, gave people an opportunity. If they didn't like the idea, they could get out. And then he went ahead and did it. And he did it responsibly in stages. And he's continued to do it responsibly in stages. And if you look at what he's done, he's been very strategic and methodical in how he's approached his cap table, right? Whether it's senior bonds, we own some of the senior bonds, by the way, or convertible. And the Silvergate transaction was, I mean, brilliant in the context of buying back the Bitcoin, right, at a discount. Few people can say that they bought Bitcoin at a discount, right? Saylor can say that, although he probably doesn't want to brag too much about it.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. For the audience, can you maybe like dive into like what even is a cap table? I feel like, you know, a lot of people watching this may be into Bitcoin. Sure. They may know like basics of like, hey, I can log into E-Trade and buy MicroStrategy, or I can buy this block ETF. But like, what is a cap table? And like, maybe break down like super high level, like sure. What you were talking about with MicroStrategy.
Sure, sure. So you've got debt and you've got equity. Sometimes you have preferred in between, right? In the case of MicroStrategy, he has the debt, which he's got senior debt, and he's got convertible debt. Now the senior obviously comes ahead of the convert debt, right? And then you also had bank debt, which was even more senior than the senior debt. So your credit risk is different depending on your position in the cap table, right, and the bonds. And it's all really spelled out in the bond indentures. And then when you go lower, you might have some preferred, which preferreds ahead of the equity. But where I'm going on Michael's cap table, he's got two classes of stock, right? His founder shares, which gives him control over the company. So he is diluting the shareholders with his purchases of Bitcoin. They're owning a smaller piece, right, of the company, but increasing the Bitcoin exposure. But he's managing his control over the company. And by the way, just to be really clear, thankfully he's got that position. I'm very much a fan of a founder class shares when the founder is really smart, which I think is Michael Saylor's position. And we've talked a number of times. I'm a little bit biased, I have to admit that. Nice. But we've sold at different times MicroStrategy stock because it's gotten too big in the portfolio. It's just our process, right?
He's doing too well then, I guess.
Well, that's exactly right, and which is a good thing. And part of the reason why we bought the bonds is we thought the bonds in the 70s were such a great value to pick up yield that it was a very secure way of getting the Bitcoin exposure. And ironically, something that people don't necessarily appreciate, I think, in the bond market, which is kind of a surprise, as he's been buying more Bitcoin, right, through his selling of equity, he's actually strengthening the position for the senior bonds. So,
yeah,
I'm getting a nice coupon.
That is super interesting because it's almost like, I feel like in today's financial system without Bitcoin, everyone's incentivized to like take on a ton of debt, leverage up as much as possible. And then Bitcoin's kind of like the opposite where like, actually now we're trying to strengthen the balance sheet, make our company more resilient in times of hardship. And that's kind of a different change from, I guess, what we've seen in history of finance.
Well, it's interesting that you asked the question about cap structure or cap tables, because I say this, you know, respectfully, probably a lot of folks who are focused on Bitcoin don't think about cap tables, right? They're thinking, this is what I want to own, and it's just one asset, you know, on the balance sheet. So, interesting.
100%. I know we were talking about this a little bit earlier, talking about how Bitcoin's volatility is just quite extreme, unlike any other probably asset you've dealt with over the years. How do you, like, you know, dive deeper into that. Like, how do you think about navigating Bitcoin's extreme volatility? Like, when people, you know, put a lot of money in the ETF, or you talk to the CEOs of companies that you own in the ETF, like, how do they think about Bitcoin's extreme volatility?
A couple of questions there. So most of the people I talk to about investing in block are financial advisors. So their question is, how do I position this high volatile theme in my portfolio? And, you know, candidly, my answer is it's a growth strategy, right? And it should be, you know, 2-4% of somebody's portfolio. And, you know, why is that? Well, you know, listen, 1 year we were up about 80, another year we were down about 60, this year we're up about 50. You've got to size your risk right, or you can't sleep at night. And we do our best to manage that risk. And you'll see some names in the portfolio that are, well, they're not considered pure plays. Walmart, IBM, Accenture. I mean, these are big companies that, well, you know, it isn't necessarily driving the price of the company's stock, but these are companies that unequivocally are taking advantage and trying to capitalize on the blockchain trend, right? In the case of Walmart, it's absolutely about the supply chain. IBM as well, right? They're actually, you know, have worked together in certain respects to, with IBM providing the technology and Walmart being the user, right? And Accenture as well, as another example. So we will increase positions like those if we get very concerned around the price action of Bitcoin, right? And they naturally go down in proportion when Bitcoin's rallying because, well, you know, the miners will rally, right? You know, as a result of that. And we came in, I guess it was probably the fourth quarter, around 9-10% in the Bitcoin miners. So we'll also increase that exposure if we start seeing a rally in Bitcoin. And, you know, we're a $500 million fund, so we have to, you know, make decisions strategically, sometimes a little early, which has some challenges, right? But, you know, these days, which is wonderful, there's great liquidity in these miners. When we started doing this in 2018, you know, the liquidity wasn't the same. And then we were about a $200 million fund. So I'm glad to see, going back to the whole conversation around cap structures, that so many of these companies have grown and raised so much money because it's increased the liquidity in the space.
Yeah, definitely agree. That's awesome for the Bitcoin miners. I'm curious, you know, of those seven categories that you invest in within the ETF, like, do you, and maybe it's a specific opportunity within one of these categories, or it's like a specific category overall, like, do you have a favorite opportunity or investment or company that you are really interested in at this point?
Oh, you're asking me to pick my favorite child or my favorite,
Maybe like not a favorite. I mean, like, what's one or two of the top ones that you really like?
Yeah, I mean, listen, our biggest position right now is Overstock, like I said before, and it's the venture capital side that is appealing to me, but it's interesting how the company right now is truly transforming itself, meaning that Overstock, are you familiar with the company, by the way?
Is Preston Byrne, was that the founder, or is that the CEO?
Patrick Byrne, yeah.
Patrick Byrne, yes. I'm somewhat familiar, but not like super familiar.
Yeah. So I literally go back to this company back to 1999, during the dot-com era. And Patrick stood up, ironically, in front of his father, who was on the board of Berkshire Hathaway. And he was explaining what he was going to be doing, right? And, you know, at the time, he was going to be challenging Amazon, which if you think back, may have been a great thesis, but how do you execute on something like that? And his father, I'll never forget this, stands up and starts drilling him, you know, and questioning how he was going to do this in front of the IPO luncheon and everybody there. So I guess where I was going with that is Overstock's had a lot of transformational situations in its history. But today, having bought Bed Bath & Beyond's IP and websites and brand, they're now going to be converting and not be Overstock. So what does that mean? That means that they're no longer going to be known as, well, just a cheap place to buy things, right? They're going to be transforming into a business that is still focused around the home, but focused around servicing their clients, their consumers, with higher quality items. I mean, that's like, what did it cost them? It cost them $21.5 million to see a $400 million jump in their market value. I mean, that's a home run. You got to give them credit for that. Now, why are we in the stock? It has a very little to do with the transaction that just took place. But listen, you know, they had $300 million in cash. They had $1.7 billion in revenues. And they had this portfolio of venture capital companies that goes back to Patrick, right? And that's what really excited me about the stock. Now, I'm co-portfolio manager with Mike Venuto on it, and he goes back as well to the Overstock days. And you know, Overstock, you talk about volatility, that can be a very volatile stock for a lot of reasons. But where I was going with it, so there's T0 as a very well-known holding in the Medici portfolio, and there's Grain Chain, right? And one is, Grain Chain's all about the farming industry and putting information on the blockchain to affect lower costs in Central America for the farmers, right? That is hugely valuable, right? To lower the cost from, we'll say, 20-30% as a farmer down to high double digits, right? If you can affect that kind of change on a business and an industry, that's really exciting to me. In the case of T0, it's all about a management play on David Kunz and his ability to deliver a business plan that offers tokenization on their platform. Well, we'll see. I mean, that's part of venture capital. Remember, I originally got into the business at a family office that had a venture capital portfolio. And when it hits, it usually hits big. And I really like outcomes that are big when I can manage the risk, right? And I, you know, I'm not really surprised that Overstock did the right thing and all of a sudden the stock is exploding like it is.
Nice, yeah. That's really awesome. I also want to get somewhat into like your macro perspective. Like, I feel like some people think, you know, that we're going into a recession. You know, we've had high inflation for a significant amount of time now. It's starting to come back down. Unemployment, you know, is still pretty low, hasn't really started ticking up in any meaningful way. What do you think is going on macro-wise? Like, what are you looking at?
Hey, everyone. This week, I want to talk about Stampseed. This is very cool metal plate where you can literally stamp your Bitcoin seed phrase with this hammer that they sell you into this metal plate. This is a must-have for all Bitcoin holders. If you have taken self-custody of your Bitcoin, you want to make sure you've recorded your seed phrase on something that is fireproof, waterproof, and time-resistant. This is a great product for Bitcoiners who have taken self-custody and want that extra level of security and resiliency to store their Bitcoin. So if you are interested in this product, definitely check out stampseed.com. Use code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off the entire website. This expires at the end of May, so go to stampseed.com today.
I've spent the last 20 years looking at TLT, the treasury, 20-year treasury. And I look at it as a signal on you know, what's happening in the bond market. And, you know, for 30 years, the bond market's just been an easy directional bet. That's changed, right? We'll see for how long it's changed. It's disrupted a lot of businesses. It's created a lot of fear. But, you know, I'm looking at TLT. I'm looking at the optimism in the equity markets overall. But the problem is the equity markets, the performance has been very concentrated. And today, by the way, I'm sure you're aware of this, Apple just broke $3 trillion, right? Wow. Kudos to them. You know, here we are going into July 4th weekend and Apple is worth $3 trillion. I guess around December, it was only worth $2 trillion. So now the question becomes, because I'm answering your question on what am I looking at closely? I'm looking at Apple. I mean, I don't think people look at Apple as an asset class. I do. And it's an asset class in many ways, the same way Bitcoin is. I mean, it's a store of value, I would argue, Apple is. It's a different kind of store of value, but it is a store of value. And for a lot of folks, it's been a wonderful store of value. But as much as people seem to be skeptical around Bitcoin and why it's worth what it is, I actually push back on why Apple is worth what it is. Listen, next quarter, when they report, if they hit their numbers, they're more expensive. Why is that? Because the revenues are lower and their earnings are lower than the previous year. But isn't that supposed to make you more expensive in equity analysis? Yeah. Now, they may beat their numbers, but okay, so they have flat numbers and a stock up 50% or 30% rather, not 50%. And what will happen if there's ever a hiccup in Apple stock? I really, really worry about that, because where is that incremental next buyer of Apple if it starts going down? So on a risk-reward basis, I very much worry about Apple, almost more than the economy. So are we going into recession? Yeah, we're going into recession. I don't think it's a big deal. Maybe it'll be a short, shallow recession. It's all kind of a healthy part of the process. I don't know. Maybe Jerome Powell will run for president and pull Gensler in as his treasurer. We could have some fun with that theory, right? And I'm sure it's not going to happen, don't get me wrong. But maybe, who knows?
Yeah, no. Your point about Apple is crazy. I saw that $3 trillion today, because if I remember correctly, like, I think it became a $1 trillion asset like 2018, 2019. And it did, you know, like a 3X from there. It's pretty mind-blowing, honestly.
It is mind-blowing because, you know, law of large numbers don't work that way.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So what does it really mean? And this is the scary part, too. So why is the stock going up like it is? Well, I'm just glad they can buy another $90 billion of stock. Yeah. that's a lot.
Yeah, it's crazy. And like, for it to double from here, I mean, that would be basically, I guess, a $6 trillion asset, which, like you said, maybe the risk-reward isn't really quite there for people invested in Apple.
Oh, and by the way, just for the record, I'm an Apple user. I've got my iPad, phone.
Same.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful product.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally agree. They definitely have people hooked on the iPhone. I think everyone keeps trying to buy their iPhone. we can wrap it up a little bit with Bitcoin. I'm curious to get some of your thoughts here. Like, you know, Bitcoin obviously is very different from equities. Doesn't spit off, you know, any positive cash flow like Bitcoin, the asset. I know you're deep into Bitcoin miners, which you know, actually do can generate some positive cash flow. Do you think like Bitcoin as an asset that like has no native yield, can it perform well in a high interest rate environment, kind of like we're seeing as of right now? Or, you know, will rates need to be like 0% for Bitcoin to do really well?
Yeah. Great question. A little bit of irony, you know, to that point, though. You know, Berkshire Hathaway doesn't throw off a dividend, but people are willing to own that because, well, it goes up, right? And Warren Buffett makes sure that it goes up. And that whole culture of you know, Buffeteers, you know, are big believers in what that company's about. I think there are a lot of similarities to Bitcoin. I think maybe I'm unique in that view. You know, similar is in the context of financial discipline, right? Similar in the context that it is about a worldview, right? And ironically, while everybody looks to Warren Buffett as the leader, you know, Satoshi is there too, right? And the last comment that I would make that I find fun is, you know, there's always some criticism around Bitcoiners and how, you know, they go to these big events and are hodling together and everything. Well, wait, I mean, the annual meeting at Berkshire Hathaway is totally that way, right? 30,000 people gather together to hear Warren Buffett and Munger speak about what Berkshire Hathaway is all about. It's just an interesting analogy. So where do I see Bitcoin going, or, you know, the change? I'm really more focused, because remember, I look at everything from an equity perspective, right? So I'm looking at Bitcoin as having wonderful utility value in changing many, many different industries. And to less degree, I think at this point, am I focused on all the other coins that exist, right? I've always been mostly on the Bitcoin. I'm not like myopic in my view, don't get me wrong. But you know, when I think about different industries changing, like the real estate market changing in terms of HELOCs, Michael Cagney is somebody you should definitely get on the on your show from Figure. Changing that industry, right? Someday, I just hope they can get rid of title insurance. It's just silly. Don't get me wrong, I think title insurance is important, but I don't think you need that middleman. It could be on the blockchain. You know, that's I would love to see that happen, right? I just think that I would love to also see, you know, more control over my own identity. Right. Think about how that could change so many different industries. Right. The healthcare industry is going to change unequivocally because of blockchain. Right. And people are spending tons of money on seeing that change. Right. You didn't touch on this, but or maybe you did when you asked my question or asked me a question about what am I looking at? I'm looking at venture capital, too, spending on, you know, through venture capitalists. And that's clearly pulled back of late. And I was talking to a VC guy I know, and he said, yeah, so when somebody wants money for an investment in a blockchain company, I'm also asking the question, how does it impact AI, right? You know, what you're trying to do. So there's, I think it's not really a surprise that blockchain and AI are going to come together in certain ways, right? AI is going to end up using smart contracts. I don't think that's a novel thesis. I think it's just inevitable.
Yeah. One last question on the VC side of things. I'm curious to your thoughts. Like, with more uncertain times and, you know, VCs, I guess, allocating less capital than they did, you know, back in 2021 per se, like, does the strategy for, like, picking VC firms or as, like, a VC change? Like, would you rather be buying seed stage companies, or would you rather be buying like Series C companies? Like, is there like a better risk reward just because like there's more uncertainty, or does it not matter? Like, there's value no matter what the size of the early stage company is. Do you have any thoughts on that question?
Well, it's interesting you asked that question. I was talking to somebody at Galaxy Digital. I guess it was probably in the fourth quarter of last year. And the quality of the deals are improving. The multiple on a real business exists today, right? I think that's a good thing. I think people are forced to be careful with their capital. I think that's a good thing too, right? To answer your question, I mean, it's always going to be a function of what that VC's mandate is, right? The one I was talking to the other day is always about early stages because they diversify their risk and they're, you know, investing 100 different companies, right? And if three of them really hit, it covers the cost and the losses from all the others. And that's their mandate, right? You know, they're just rolling the dice a bit and going through their process of how to identify the huge winners. So I think you need both, because you need that starter venture capital to help that starter venture capital achieve their next level of operations.
Yeah, it's a great point. Dan, this is awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. Where can the audience learn more about you and learn more about your ETF?
So if they go, they Google my name, they're going to, I'm for sure, find my Twitter account, ETF Think Tank, I'm sorry, ETF Professor. They can also find out information about me on the ETF Think Tank. If they go to the Amplify website, and again, they Google Amplify and Block, they'll get, you know, our full list of holdings, our monthly blog, all our disclosures that I hope they read very carefully, given the potential volatility that we're always going to be seeing. And I'm here. Listen, DM me, connect with me on LinkedIn. I love questions. And Joe, you know, here's the reality. I mean, ideas come from everybody, right? I think probably, you know, some of my best ideas have come through random connections with people. So I really welcome anybody who wants to reach out.